Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why do people seem to know so little about politics? And what does that mean for democracy? We'll speak with political scientist Arthur Lupia. But first, the normalized violence and growing authoritarianism in Turkey and what that means for the country, the region, and even the European Union. Fatma Mujer-Gocek is a professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Michigan and the author of several books, including East Encounters West, France and the Ottoman Empire in the 18th Century, Social Construction of Nationalism in the Middle East, The Transformation of Turkey, and co-editor of A Question of Genocide, Armenians and Turks at the End of the Ottoman Empire. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
So you've been studying the developments in Turkey as a state, really as far back as when it was the Ottoman Empire to today. The developments suggest that Turkey is going through some changes, and some people said that it was considered before kind of this model of possibility of democracy in the Middle East, but that it's now looking more and more like an authoritarian government. Would you agree with this assessment?
I totally do, yes. Unfortunately, the level of democracy in Turkey has really gone down very significantly. There are more than a couple of thousand journalists in prison, as well as others who have just expressed their opinions publicly. And if it is in any way critical of the government or the state, they end up in prison.
I understand that there are some scholars who are also being imprisoned as a result of criticizing the government.
Yes, well, I am one of them, actually. So let me answer that question in two parts. I will first tell you what's happening, you know, and then I will also, if you let me, talk about its connections to the Armenian genocide denial, because I think the two events are very connected, unfortunately. Now, what has been happening in Turkey is that recently, because President Erdogan wants to become the president by himself, abolishing basically the post of the prime minister, there were two elections carried out in the year 2015 because he needs a majority in the National Assembly to be able to go ahead with that. And AK Party, his party, lost some votes in the first one, first election, and there was supposed to be a coalition government, but he said no coalition whatsoever, they want a majority government. And then that is when he stopped the peace process with the Kurds. Kurds are now the most significant minority in Turkey. They're about 15 to 20% of the population, probably actually in numbers what Armenians would have been in Turkey had they not been massacred 100 years ago. The peace process meant that PKK, which is the basically the armed organization of the Kurds and the Turkish military, went into peace. There were negotiations. There were some rights given to the Kurds locally in their municipalities and such. And some Kurdish deputies also, some Kurdish politicians were allowed to run for office and then they were elected to the Turkish National Assembly. But what happened was that when the Kurdish party was able to garner a lot of vote in the first election, President Erdogan decided that the only way to get more votes basically was by eliminating the Kurdish-leaning party and by promoting violence again. And that is when he started advocating violence against all the Kurds in the southeast eastern region. And there were many cities, towns that were brought under siege. There were special ops people as well as the military, gendarmerie that went after civilians and other and laid siege on many towns. There was some reaction, so there were fights, some reaction from the PKK, that is mostly in the rural regions, but they have YPG, which is the PKK wing fighting in the cities. And that is when there was a lot of violence against the Kurds, as a consequence of which many academics in Turkey and others like me elsewhere, at first about 1,200 of us and later about 2,200 of us, signed a peace petition that said, please Turkish state and government, we want you to solve the problem you have with the Kurds, not through violence, but through peace and negotiation. That is why it's called the peace petition. But what happened is that Erdogan, President Erdogan, said that this was by saying that this is what we wanted and by criticizing the state and government for their violence, he decided that we were siding with the terrorists and therefore we too were terrorists. He said there is no difference between a terrorist, which he calls Kurdish fighters, terrorist's gun and an academic's pen. So as a consequence, he ordered all of the Institute of Higher Education, that's sort of is an umbrella organization overseeing all the other universities, to start investigations into these, into all of us. Many of them, about 30 to 40 academics who signed, lost their jobs. Four who actually read the petition during a press release were imprisoned, and they are now released, but they are on trial. And they are now all trying to figure out, I guess, the state, the government, and also the judiciary, which obviously is not independent of the state and the government, are all now trying to figure out how to prosecute all these people who have signed. So that is what is going on with respect to the peace petition and jailed or exiled academics.
Let's back up just a little bit and understand what has happened with the Kurdish communities, especially recently. As I understand, when the conflict started with the organization that calls itself the Islamic State, that the Turkish government was sort of using that as cover to attack Kurdish communities. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. Because what happens is that Kurds at the moment are spread out because they don't have their own state. They just have a regional government in Iraq. There are also in Iran, Syria, and Turkey. So when the conflict started in Syria, of course, the Kurds also were armed themselves and were already armed anyhow in order to protect their own territory. So they started fighting against ISIS. And that puts Turkey in a difficult position because Turkey actually initially backed ISIS together with Saudi Arabia and Qatar because those are all Sunnis. And the current government and head of government in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is Shi'i. So they thought that by bringing down Assad, they would decrease the Shi'i presence in the Middle East. But that backfired, and ISIS not only got money from them, but turned against them. And basically said that Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey were also infidel governments because they did not have religion properly interpreted in the societies. But while that was going on, of course, there was a very bizarre triangle because Turkey claimed it was attacking ISIS, but it wasn't. But on the other hand, it was trying to contain the Kurds so that the Kurds in these different countries wouldn't unite to form their own state, which they were in the process of doing. And that is the sort of the triangulation that makes it very messy.
Simultaneously, we started out discussing how Erdogan is now consolidating power. And so the prime minister recently stepped down.
Well, he was forced to step down, yeah.
So I'd like to understand what happened there.
Then, of course, there is another demand. I mean, this is why things in the Middle East are so complex. Because of this fighting, which they thought initially, Turks and Saudis and the Qataris thought would only go for a couple of weeks and then Bashar al-Assad will be ousted and then, you know, there will be this alternative Sunni government in Syria. Well, that didn't happen. I mean, you know, it's been going on for a couple of years now, you know, and as a consequence, there have been about 3 million Syrians who left Syria. About 2.7 million of them have ended up in Turkey. And initially, Erdogan thought that he could basically host all these Syrians who would then sort of go back and reclaim Syria as the alternative, you know, government. But of course, that hasn't happened. So now he's stuck with all these, unfortunately, refugees who do not get much legal protection in Turkey at all. And many of them don't want to stay in Turkey. So many of them started to go through Greece to go to Europe to be safe. And when that happened, of course, European Union wasn't ready for it. And as a consequence, Angela Merkel and Erdogan in 2015 signed this agreement where Europe was supposed to give them about 6 billion euros in return for keeping the refugees. So Erdogan is using the Syrian refugees as a pawn against Europe, and that is why European Union, even though democracy is going down the tubes in Turkey, is not very willing to intervene in the Turkish democracy or lack thereof. And that is the Syrian refugee angle of this whole thing.
So that is also what complicates the issue with Turkey pursuing membership into the European Union.
Exactly.
What's happening there?
Yes, in return, Erdogan wanted 6 billion, and he also wanted Turks to be able to enter European countries without a visa. And they were going to go along with that, but for membership, there are 72 clauses that Turkey has to fulfill. One of the very significant ones is sort of getting rid of the anti-terrorism laws, according to which Turkish state can just arrest whoever they want and keep them for a very long time. But they weren't willing to do that, and they're not going back on that. So as a consequence, it looks like the whole deal may not work out. And the way Davutoğlu figures into this is that the Prime Minister Davutoğlu was the one who negotiated this whole deal with Europe. As a consequence, the Europeans had a much easier time dealing with him than with Erdogan, because Erdogan basically is a politician, is not educated much at all, and is very emotional, and it's much better in rhetoric than actually negotiating agreements as such. And when he saw that Europe was much more preferring Davutoğlu over himself, he decided Davutoğlu had to go. And someone instead would come who would at least be a yes-sayer to everything that Erdogan wanted, and not have a presence independent of Erdogan.
I had understood they were actually pretty close allies, the Prime Minister and the President.
Yes, they used to be, because they both thought they were fighting for the Islamic cause, and that's at least what Davutoğlu thought initially. But Erdogan has this way of using people and then throwing them when he's, you know, throwing them away when he's exploited them enough, I guess. He's moved on.
There are other aspects that I had understood, including that the Prime Minister had been trying to essentially put in a few checks and balances into the government so that it wouldn't be essentially one dictator running the country. But that has ostensibly not happened.
No.
And I understand there's also Erdogan trying to control the judiciary with the appointments and control the media, not just by jailing the journalists, but also by taking over media as well. Can you give us a rundown of all of these efforts?
Exactly. There's only, I think, two newspapers that are independent of Erdogan's control out of like 30 of them. So basically, yes, one by one, he eliminated all of them. And he thinks by doing this, he's uniting the country. I mean, in his own weird imaginary, he sees the country and the Turkish nation only as comprising of those who voted for him. And he doesn't consider the rest a part of Turkey or citizens, which, of course, he is not supposed to do as the president. He is supposed to be the president of all the people, citizens of Turkey living in Turkey. But he is extremely partisan, and he only looks after his own voters and not others. And that's what makes him a dictator.
You're not in prison now.
No, but if I were to go to Turkey, the chances of me being in prison are quite high. And that's why, for the first time in my life, I cannot go back to Turkey, because I also signed that peace petition. And, of course, I have worked on the Armenian genocide and the Turkish denial of the genocide. So I can definitely not give any talks when I'm there. And given the way in which the judiciary works, which is like totally random and precarious, I basically cannot take the chance to go back.
So there is no possibility of a fair trial, even if somebody were to go
to court. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, because a doctoral student of ours here had a similar problem, and it turns out, you know, they are booking and keeping tabs on everyone, including Twitter accounts, Facebook postings and everything, and all the articles and things you've written. And even if you have done academic work, they have the judiciary interpret that as aiding and abetting the terrorists. I mean, so, for example, I'm now working after the violence against the Armenians. I'm looking into the violence against the Kurds. I'm learning Kurdish. I'm reading things, and I'm working on Kurdish history. If I write anything on the Kurds, even though I'm just writing academic articles, they have members of the judiciary that would interpret that as basically treason against the Turkish state. And then, of course, yeah, I would end up in jail.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking with Fatma Mujay Gocek about authoritarianism and normalization of violence in Turkey. The petition that you have signed and that other academics have signed as well is really calling for peace, and yet you're saying that this is interpreted as terrorism.
Because it's criticizing the government and state, and it's criticizing the violence that the government and state have undertaken against the Kurds. And, you know, as academics, we do care about social justice, and that's why we're in academia. And you cannot see a major group in your country be slaughtered without saying anything about it. So we all thought that we had to take a stand, and that's why I signed it, as I would in any other case, because, as I said, it reminds me so much about what happened to the Armenians a century ago. The parallels are eerie. As a consequence, there is, of course, in the interim, what happened to the Jews in Europe. I mean, these are all similar cases of mass destruction that at least those of us who still have a backbone and an ethical stand have to take a stand against. And that's what we did.
So let's also tie this into some of the other scholarship that you've done. You've been studying
yes.
things like nationalism in Turkey, and you've
yes.
connected it to this sort of hegemony of one majority in the country, and then the
yeah.
collective myth to support it. How would you
yes.
help us to understand how that has occurred in Turkey over time?
I think the most important thing to remember is that mass violence occurs in many different societies, is mostly conducted in the 20th century by the states under one, you know, legitimation or another, nationalism, of course, being the most significant one. But what enables societies and states to sort of become more democratic and go beyond these past atrocities is coming to terms and acknowledging what they have done, paying the consequences of their actions, the violence, and also, therefore, becoming more tolerant and inclusive as a consequence. So this is at least what has happened in those cases that are now viable democracies throughout the world. And that is why I was initially interested in the Armenian genocide, because I knew that it was the foundational violence in Turkey, and I was, at the time, very interested in figuring out why Turkey can never become a democracy. This was all, you know, before the Sol-Kurdish massacre started. And I was certain that one of the main reasons why Turkey could not become a democracy is that it failed to acknowledge and come to terms with this foundational violence of the Armenian genocide. That is why I was very interested in studying the Turkish state denial and the societal denial that goes along with it, because I was certain that if Turkish state and society did not come to terms with this violence, they would never democratize, for the mere fact that if you do not atone for the violence you have committed, you think that violence is the way through which to solve everything. And that is what happened. Since all the perpetrators of the violence against the Armenians then became the leaders of the Turkish Republic, they normalized that using violence to solve everything. And I think once you normalize violence in a society, you can never democratize, because every resistance, every opposition then, rather than using diplomacy and peace would end with you using force and violence. And that is indeed what happened. And I said at the time, I said, look, unless we come to terms with what happened in the past against the Armenians, unless we understand and at least punish symbolically all those perpetrators, and also then therefore become more tolerant and inclusive, this violence is going to repeat itself, I said, against the Kurds. And guess what happens?
Yeah.
The book comes out in the same year, basically in 2015, the violence against the Kurds started to escalate, because Erdogan also, when he was captured, turned once again to violence to solve this problem he encountered. That is the continuity between the massacres of the Armenians and the present massacre of the Kurds, which makes me extremely upset, distressed, and sad.
It's interesting, too, because during the Armenian genocide, of course, the Kurds were used as an ally of
exactly.
the Ottoman Turks to
exactly.
slaughter Armenians, and now they are being slaughtered yeah. themselves. I wonder, too...
Yes, well, they said that, they say Armenians, Turks had Armenians for breakfast, and they're having us for lunch or supper, as the case may be. Yes, they do realize that. And that is actually one of the things that I found in all the interviews that I conducted with the Kurds. They all mentioned the Armenian genocide, and that seems to be a very important turning point in their presence in Turkey, because they see it as the beginning of the end, because they realize that potentially Armenians were their main allies, could have been their main allies, and they ended up destroying the Armenians, which led them to be much less protected against the Turks, the Turkish state, and they have been experiencing violence since then. And to give them credit, they also, about 10 years ago, acknowledged the genocide and apologized to the Armenians for
yeah.
what they had done.
That's a very big step to take. What is Erdogan's popularity level in Turkey now?
Yes,
what do people think?
This is the sad part. He probably has, and his party has, anywhere between 48% to 52% of the vote, which then leaves the other 48% to 52% against him. And that is what makes the situation so polarizing and difficult, because he has half the population supporting him, whereas the other half are virulently against him. And to give him credit and AK Party, you know, they have been spending time since the 80s basically, literally mobilizing all these people into voters for themselves. I mean, so they've been working on this population for the last 30, 35 years. And the rest of them are, of course, mostly secular people who put other values other than religion before in making up their decisions. His popularity still seems to continue. And, of course, violence is usually much more prone to increase the votes of those people who are in positions of power.
I wanted to tie this into something else that you wrote about, which was about creating a collective memory. And I wonder how that plays into his popularity of about 48% to 52%. Do you think it plays a role?
Of course. That is extremely important. There are, of course, with respect to the violence against the Armenians, both the official narratives whitewashed basically all that violence and the genocide out of all the Turkish textbooks. That is why many few people know about what happened in the past and how much that has shaped adversely the society that they live in. With respect to Erdogan, because he has a more religious stand, he sees the secular Republic of Turkey that was, you know, founded in 1923 and pretty much continued until 2003 when Erdogan's party came to power. He sees them as a sort of diversion in Turkish history, and he wants to go back to the Ottoman Empire. The problem, of course, is that the Ottoman Empire he goes back to is not one that he knows, because he's not very educated, as I said, and he probably doesn't even have a university diploma, even though he claims he does. It is probably one that is fake one. He does not see the diversity in the empire that used to be there and the tolerance, and he tries to basically take his unitary sort of dictatorial ideas and then use this imagined Ottoman past as a way to legitimate his actions. So that is what makes it very scary in terms of the collective memory, because he is very carefully subverting that. And unfortunately, the population in Turkey, where the level of education is at elementary school, fourth grade level, also, and most of the people who vote for him are much less educated, I also go along with Erdogan's interpretation that do not have any basis in history.
Finally, the petition that you and other scholars have started, I think it is called We Will Not Be a Party to This Crime. What are the goals that you and the other scholars who have started this, what is it that you're asking for?
Well, it is very important to note that the state presence in Turkey has been very strong. And I think the university professors represent probably the most significant intellectuals in civil society. They thought that by taking a stand against this crime against the Kurds, but more broadly crime against humanity, because you cannot destroy people who have not, in most cases, taken an armed resistance to you. We were hoping that we would at least swerve Turkey back into a peaceful solution. That was the first step. The second step was to also include the Kurds within the Turkish democratic system peacefully, so that they could, as they did, were being represented in the Turkish National Assembly, and also have maybe partial local sovereignty in administering their domestic affairs, and live as a multicultural society that is much more peaceful and democratic and inclusive than it is at the moment. That is at least, I think, what I aspired to when I signed, and I hope the others did as well.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here and helping us understand what the developments are there in Turkey and its relationship to the West. Great to have you with us here. Fatma Mujeh Göçek.
You're most welcome. Thank you for enabling me to at least share with you what saddens me and, you know, really makes me very anxious about Turkey and its futures, democratic futures, or lack thereof.
Fatma Mujeh Göçek is a professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Michigan and the author of several books, including East Encounters West, France and the Ottoman Empire in the 18th Century, Social Construction of Nationalism in the Middle East, The Transformation of Turkey, and co-editor of A Question of Genocide, Armenians and Turks at the End of the Ottoman Empire. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll explore uninformed voters and democracy. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why do people seem to know so little about politics? And what does that mean for democracy? Arthur Lupia is with us. Arthur Lupia is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and research professor at the Institute for Social Research. He's the author of The Democratic Dilemma, Stealing the Initiative, and the latest, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Arthur Lupia. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me.
In your introduction, you give us a sense of how much information there really is out there and how we could never really master it. So like how much governments do, laws that are passed, rules that are promulgated, decisions by the courts. Give us a sense of how much there really is and why you say we can't possibly know all this.
Well, sometimes when we talk about politics, particularly when we're frustrated, we like to tell stories about the ignorant voters, the people who disagree with us. And if only they knew certain things, they'd come around and be better citizens. So we can sit there and ask about, well, who are these ignorant citizens? And if we think about it for a moment, and all the things you could know about politics, what we realize is there's really two types of people. One type of person recognizes that there's so much that they don't know about politics, and the other type is delusional about how much they know. And so the example would be, in the United States, where I live, the Congress, even when it seems to be dysfunctional, passes 200 to 300 laws per year, and the state where I live passes another 200 laws per year, and the city in which I live passes about 100 laws a year. Even though I'm known as one of the world's experts on political information, I couldn't name more than 10 of the laws, I think, in any given year. Moreover, after a law is written, usually there are rules about how it's enforced. And those rules typically, every word has the rule of law in the sense that, you know, the interpretation written in a rule is binding. So I know almost nothing about that. And that puts me in the same place as everyone. So if we're going to look at the ignorant voters, you know, the first place we have to look is in the mirror. But that doesn't mean that we cast bad votes, because if you think about how we drive in traffic or what we understand about the food we eat, there's all kinds of questions we can't answer. And yet many of us live to a ripe old age by driving and eating. And the way that we do that is by finding simple pieces of information that lead us to make really good decisions. And so a lot of what my book is about is when people can do that and when they can't do that, and how we as educators can help them do a better job.
You've talked about attention, learning, and retention. What do we need to understand about how people think and decide and remember in order to be able to have a relatively civically educated citizenship?
Yeah, that's a great question. So suppose that you and I or some members of our audience wanted to teach some children or other adults in our community something about a policy, something about the way it affected our lives, or something about how our future could be if we made different choices. The question now is, how do we convey that information? One way of thinking about it is just the facts. That is, if we lay the facts out in front of people, if we repeat the facts enough, if we, you know, make long books or give long lectures, detailed lectures about the facts, at some point the information will go through. The problem is that biology doesn't work that way. That's not really how brains work. In particular, there are so many things competing for our attention at any given moment. And even when somebody throws a book in front of us or stands in front of us and give a lecture, we always have the option not to pay attention. To be polite, we often pretend we're paying attention, but we can think about our laundry or sports or whatever it is. And so to achieve the learning outcomes that we typically desire, a critical thing is to try and provide information that not only helps people make better decisions, but that also gets their attention. When we're trying to get people's attention, the thing that, you know, someone like myself or you know, people in the media have to think about is we're competing. We're competing with other noises in the room. And we're competing with all the things online, like cat videos, which many people find very entertaining. And so to the extent that we want our messages to get through, we have to find a way to outcompete the other things to which they could pay attention. And to make a long story short, the types of information that people really like are information that they can see as helping them solve a problem that they have. So if we want to talk about global climate change, for example, people don't see that as a problem that they have, but they do see dirty water and dirty air and pollution as problems that they have. And so beginning to tell a story about things that they can do to improve the water and air in that neighborhood is a gateway to helping people be more interested in things like global climate change. So in order to get people's attention, you really have to speak to their core concerns and their core values.
Is this what you were referring to when you talked about cues?
Yes, cues are a big deal. So if you and I are out for a drive and we are approaching an intersection and we're trying to figure out whether to hit the gas or hit the brake, there's a lot of things typically we can look at. If we're at a busy intersection, we can think about all the other drivers and their cars and how fast they could go. and what they might possibly be thinking in terms of whether they're going to go fast or slow. There are all these things we could look at, or we could listen to the radio or look at the clouds. But what a lot of us tend to do is look at stoplights, and if the stoplight's a certain color, we stop, and if it's another color, we go. And so there's this simple environmental cue that gives us a lot of information about how to make a decision that will help us. We do that all the time when we choose brand names when looking at food, or when we decide to approach or run away from an animal. And so in politics, you know, making what seems to be a complicated decision can sometimes be made a lot easier if we find the right cue. And in many countries, one of the best cues is a party label. Understanding that someone is a liberal or from a labor party or a conservative can tell people a lot about that candidate that can help them make a decision that they'll be happy about later.
And some would argue that this is the whole point of framing and political advertising and that type of a thing, storytelling even. But this can sometimes give bad information, can't it?
Yes. No. You know, when you take a shortcut, it can lead you to a place you want to go, but sometimes it leads you to a bad place. In politics, this cue-taking, I think it works well in a competitive environment where people are able to tell multiple sides of a story, and you can learn over time which cues work for you and which cues don't. So you can learn that a conservative person or a labor person is more likely to pursue the types of policies that you like or that are better for your family or your community or whatever you care about. But in some cases, when you see like a very slick TV ad and you don't know who's behind it and they make a very visceral claim and you're compelled by it, that's where this type of thinking can become very dangerous because, you know, someone can tell you that, you know, voting for the taller candidate is a great thing, and they show you a movie about how this tall candidate does lots of wonderful things. But in real life, the tall candidate is very ineffective or awful. And because you didn't think through where this information was coming from, you made the wrong choice. So cues work really well when you have time to get experience with them and learn about which ones work and which ones don't.
One of the issues that some political scientists have talked about and many civic educators talk about is the idea that voters often vote against their own interests. And this was the whole argument of Thomas Frank and What's the Matter with Kansas? And I think your colleague Larry Bartels did that one experiment that you then countered that dealt with George W. Bush's tax cuts and conservatives supporting it or not supporting it based on how much information they got. I wonder if you could help us to understand both the role of information, but other roles too that lead voters to choose against their own interests.
Let me sort of present that in a slightly different way to just help us think about that, because sometimes when we are passionate about an issue or a point of view or a policy, and we see someone else voting differently, a natural reaction to say is, how can they do that? Like, how can they not know that the issue that I prefer or the candidate I prefer is really the right way forward? And so a natural story that we tell ourselves is, well, the other person is ignorant. And if I tell them what I know, they'll change their minds and they'll see that I'm right. But what's interesting about politics is that information isn't the only thing that separates us. Values and experiences and backgrounds separate us as well. And so a policy that might be really great for me could be really bad for you. And if you had all the information that was available about it, you would still vote the other way. When I think about the questions that you've asked me, the mistake that we often make is to think, well, the only reason that someone would vote differently than I do is because they're stupid. But when you look into it, so when you look into the Thomas Frank work or the Larry Bartels work, and these types of claims are made, what I have done is shown, okay, well, why don't we learn a little bit more about these people who are voting differently than we are and try to find out that if we actually gave them more information, would they change their minds? Or if we even gave them more information years later and say, how do you feel about that choice you made 5 or 10 years ago? What we find out is they're still happy with it. And what we learn at those moments was it wasn't ignorance that distinguished us initially. It was the idea that, you know, I'm a tall person and someone else is a short person. And so we have different preferences about how tall doorways are, right? There's a difference in our life that leads us to want to make different decisions. And so I think when we look at this idea about who's casting a correct vote, one of the things you really have to consider is well, what is the other person's life like? And their circumstance might be really different than yours, in which case you might not be happy about the case that they're voting differently, but they're entirely justified in doing so.
Well, can we look at that one issue that you studied as well as your colleague Larry Bartel studied as an example that people could come to terms with, which was the tax cuts that George Bush W. Jr. Yeah. proposed?
Right. In Larry Bartel's paper, the claim was that this was in 2004 in the USA, and there was a question about how do you feel about the tax cuts that President Bush was proposing. And Bartel's claim was that the less you knew about politics, the more likely you were to support the tax cut. And so he said, well, ignorance is leading to the tax cut. But what I showed is that his result was only holding for people who identified as liberals or on the left. And when you gave conservatives more information or the equivalent of it, they actually liked the tax cuts more because that policy was consistent with their point of view. So this is a case where, you know, even leading economists disagree on whether you should have tax cuts to stimulate the economy, whether you should have government spending to stimulate the economy, or in fact, whether you should try to stimulate the economy at all. Leading economists disagree on these things. And yet some authors will write, because the public disagrees with my point of view on a tax cut, they must have been ignorant. So what I've shown in my work is that there is a large group of people in the United States, people who call themselves conservatives, who even when they're very smart by, you know, conventional measures, they still like the policies that someone like Professor Bartel thought was a bad idea.
So would this fall into, for example, in the Bush tax cuts scenario, a lot of people who may have been of little means who were not going to benefit from the tax cuts and would see the shift go to wealthier people, right? So they personally right. wouldn't benefit from the tax cut. So you're saying that ideologically, they still supported it.
There's the data that we were looking at doesn't really allow us to go much deeper, but here's a bigger idea. That we don't get to vote on one issue at a time. And so, you know, people who have lesser means may wish that, you know, they had more money or more resources. But people may have very different theories about how that should come about, you know, whether the government should give them money or redistribute it, or whether they should do something differently. And there is a different set of different points of view. Moreover, some people who are conservative, who have little means, you know, they may realize at some level that the tax cuts won't help them, but they understand that they're part of a theory of government that, in the aggregate, leads to outcomes that they like more. So, for example, you know, many people who are conservative want low government intervention in, you know, the economy. In the U.S., that point of view is tied up with certain attitudes on abortion. And so to the extent that they're saying, well, maybe on this one issue, I wish the world were different, the things that President Bush is doing in general, his theory in general, is leading to a better life for me as I see it. And so even if the tax cuts don't benefit me directly, I'm happy to go along with them. So these are all explanations that exist in the U.S. electorate, which makes the simple story, you disagree with me, so you must be wrong. It undermines that story.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking with Arthur Lupia about his new book, Uninformed, Why So Many People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Do you think that this is really supporting some of the studies that have been done among psychologists, like the Drew Weston studies that show we get sort of married to a particular perspective, and no matter what information comes in, we stick to that perspective kind of emotionally, and counter-information actually yeah. gives us cognitive dissonance?
Well, I will say, I mean, this is a conversion that I've had over my professional life. My background is in mathematics, and when I first started looking at this issue, my natural inclination was to think that we analyze information first and maybe we have feelings about it later. But what the scholarship, particularly over the last 30 years, has shown, and certainly Drew Weston's work is an example, that our typical reaction to information is to feel it first and then maybe to think about it later. And so if I feel that a piece of information is threatening to me or my point of view, one of the things I'll try to do is distance myself from it. And so that's what we see. The psychologists now call it motivated reasoning, but it's the idea that I will discount a piece of information, not because I think it's false, but because I think it's threatening. So so I'm just going to try and keep it as far away from me as I can. To the contrary, if I see a piece of information that supports my point of view, that raises my self-esteem and reminds me of how awesome I am, I'm going to try and inflate the importance of that information, and I'm going to tell everybody about it. I'm not going to inspect it very much. And so as we look at how people process information, this selective exposure and cognitive dissonance that you talked about, they're huge elements. At the same time, there's a limit to it. When we can tie a piece of information that threatens us to an outcome that we really care about, we think about it, right? That's how we learn. And it's these critical moments where, you know, we can adopt a new perspective or find a new sympathy for someone. So it's not simply the case that we make a set of decisions when we're 20 and then we never change our minds.
So this has to do with also another question you've looked at about scaring citizens.
That's right. One of the great opportunities for civic educators today is to try and figure out how to take a piece of information and tell a story about it in a way that connects to the lives that people lead and the things that they think are important. And when you do that, people are willing to listen, right? And so if you tell people that they have a bad ideology or that they're wrong, they tend to shut you down. They tend to ignore you. But one of the great, I think, largely untapped opportunities for people who really want to make a difference in society is not just to talk at someone, but to listen and to think about the lives that they lead, and then to try and convey whatever it is you know in terms of what they really think is important.
So if you look at the current political climate in the United States and the way the primary
Yes.
elections are going and the whole world is watching, how does what's happening with, you know, the primary elections and the information and the emotions fit within this model?
Sure. Well, let's talk about the Republican side, because I know that's probably more exciting and people have seen it. There's a historical note that I'm not sure is covered a lot because it's not as exciting as Donald Trump. And that is, for roughly 40 years, there's been a pretty big division within the Republican Party. There's been one group within the Republican Party who we call establishment Republicans, who have conservative principles and actually like the idea of government pursuing conservative principles. But there's another faction within the Republican Party who just really want the government out of life as much as possible. They're known as the Tea Party or Movement Conservatives. They've had an uneasy truce for about 40 years, and, you know, the political genius of someone like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush was that they found a way to talk to both of those groups simultaneously. But over the last 10 or 15 years, those groups have grown more and more apart, particularly after the economic crisis of 2008, where under President Bush, the government intervened in a pretty big way to forestall a larger economic collapse. So now we come to 2016, and you have an electorate, particularly in the Tea Party, that are really, really disappointed in the establishment Republicans. And, you know, Donald Trump, one of the first things he did was really talk to that type of voter and say, I understand that you're frustrated, and I'm going to give you some simple ways out of it. We're going to keep the Mexicans away. We're going to impose tariffs. I mean, you may or may not like those policies, but he tapped into the frustration that had been in the Republican Party for 40 years in a way that no other Republican had. And so, whatever you think of Donald Trump, he clearly understood and tapped into something that, you know, a lot of people saw in the Republican Party, but no one really figured out how to cultivate. The other thing about Donald Trump that, you know, what he understands from his time in television is how to get attention. And what we may long for, the days where all political discourse was at a very high level and very long speeches and so forth, and there are people who are interested in that, so lots of people worldwide who are interested in that, but there are other folks who are just really frustrated, and Donald Trump speaks to them. And at least for the moment, he's found enough of them in the Republican Party to give him the nomination.
So how does, say, what Donald Trump has done fit into this model that you've been writing about in terms of information cues, attention getting, retention, and, you know, whether or not voter ignorance is playing into this?
Voter ignorance plays into all of it, but that's just because voter ignorance is always present. Just again, going back to the beginning, there's so many things that all of us are ignorant about. I think what Donald Trump was fantastic at was phrasing very strong ideas in two or three words. So on any given day, you knew what he was talking about and you knew what his position was. And the media here loved it. before we blame the voters for the outcome, the media could have chosen to give equal time to the candidates. And if you look at the statistics on this, you know, even the top media networks, that are, some of whom are complaining about Trump now, you know, 80 or 90% of all of their coverage was focused on Trump. So they loved this. A lot of people in the public could understand it. They could talk about what his positions were. And so that gave him an advantage. At the same time, I think as we move into the general election, simple ideas and some of the contradictions that Donald Trump has expressed, just, you know, he's contradicted himself in quite a few occasions. I think this is where simple cues pointing out these contradictions, pointing out the lack of feasibility of some of his proposals, that somebody using the same strategies that have led him to succeed could really undermine him in the next 6 months. So, well, I think that's out there. I think the Republicans had a difficult time doing it, in part because most of the Republican consultants in this country were just counting on him to implode. And so they did not attack him early in ways that I think strategies in my book would have helped.
So in essence, what you're saying is he uses these cues, these emotional cues, that perhaps opponents should use.
If we think about in the Republican primary, at the beginning, Governor Bush, Senator Rubio, and Senator Cruz had a huge monetary advantage. They had hundreds of millions of dollars lined up behind their campaigns to run ads. And yet, Donald Trump really scooped them in terms of how to talk to an angry part, a frustrated part of the Republican electorate. And Bush and Rubio, they just never figured it out. I mean, Rubio, I think, figured it out about a week before he dropped out of the campaign. Senator Cruz has always been running a different campaign. Senator Cruz was really targeting a group of religious voters who are well identified. I mean, he did as well as any candidate who's tried to get those voters. And his message really it's not a general election message. So I don't think Cruz could have changed strategies in the way that my book would recommend and get a larger set of the electorate, because he had a pretty narrow appeal, and that was part of, you know, why he had an appeal at all. But I think it was Governor Bush and Governor Rubio who, I think their campaigns, I think they were running, you know, 2000 or 2008 era campaigns in 2016, where you really need to be more attentive to how to get people's attention.
Let's go back to framing this whole question that we're getting to, which is really how much do citizens need to know and how much information do they need to know for a democracy to really work well?
That's the big question. I'll give a simple answer, and the simple answer is the amount of information you need depends on what you're doing. So if you're in the United States of America in November of 2016, and you have a Democrat Hillary Clinton and a Republican Donald Trump, a chimp with a coin gets that right half the time, if you think that, you know, but what a voter needs to figure out is which of these two options is better. You're not writing a constitution. You're not writing a contract where there's a million options. There's two options. And so you need enough information to figure out, is the Democrat better or is the Republican better? And that's where you can count on history and what they say and what they've done to try and make a decision. That's a pretty low bar, choosing one out of two. Again, if you flip a coin, you're likely to get it right half the time. And if you can do a little better than flipping a coin by looking at history and what they do, you can do a lot better. In fact, most people who vote in presidential elections, if you ask them years later, how do you feel about that vote you've cast? You know, in part because there's only two choices, most people wouldn't change their vote. They're like, you know, I'm happy with how this has gone. Now, there are other people, if we talk about democracy working, there are some people who only have to make simple choices on certain days, and that's the typical voter. There are other people in the legislature, and there are people in the bureaucracy, and there are people who work in the judiciary, and they have really important jobs. And them being very expert on how nuclear weapons work, or what happens when you send soldiers into a particular area, or what happens when you try to change your pipes from pipes that have no lead in them to pipes that have lead. You want experts on the ground. And so information is really important to a democracy. But the key is not to try and teach everybody everything, because that's impossible, right? The key is to give people the information that they can use for the tasks that are actually in front of them. And that's why getting voter education right is so important, and that's what most of the book's about. And it's also why, you know, when we think about who we elect to office, just making sure that they know the things that they need to know.
for civic educators, and you identify all kinds of people as civic educators, besides political scientists and media people, there are really people who are active in politics, party activists, all kinds of people. What would you say that they need to be doing in order to bring people to the knowledge where they are making decisions at least consistent with what they ultimately would want?
The one thing that people in my position don't do enough is listen. So we go in front of an audience and we just start talking and we just start telling people about why what we know is so important. And I love people who know things and are willing to share it with other people. But because attention is limited, one of the most important things to know when an educator walks into the room is, why is the other person there? Why are the students there? What do they want? What are their priorities? And what are their values? And if you can find a way to speak to those things and convey your information from that framework, you'll have an audience. But if you just try to talk at people, or you threaten their values, or you don't think about why they're in the room, you just think it's some, they have some obligation to listen to you, and you're wrong about that, people will nod to be polite, but they're not paying attention, and they're not thinking. And when they leave the room, they'll have forgotten everything you've said. So the most important thing, I think, for an educator to do is to really think about what's in this moment, this potential educational moment, for the other person in the room, and how can I serve that person? If you can figure out a way to do that and convey your information, you'll have an audience. And when you measure whether or not you had an effect on them, chances are you will.
Thank you so much, Arthur Lupia, for this research and for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for having me.
Arthur Lupia is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and research professor at the Institute for Social Research. He's the author of The Democratic Dilemma, Stealing the Initiative, and the latest, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.